Gentlemen, I stand before you for the last time tonight. I want to hurriedly go over the things that my opponent has said in his last speech, and then as time permits, to get into some more material and to introduce another affirmative argument. He wanted me to identify the church. It doesn't matter if I mean the church local, like the church at Laodicea, or the church regional, the churches of Galatia, the church universal, the brotherhood, the church ethnic, the church of the churches of the Gentiles, congregational collective, the churches of Christ. Doesn't matter what I mean that whatever an individual can do upon the peculiar grounds that he's a Christian, the church can do. The brotherhood can do. The region of churches can do it. The local church can do it. Groups of churches can do it. The ethnic churches can do it. It doesn't matter. Why is that a puzzle? I don't know what he means by the church. And then he talked about two Christians going fishing. I mentioned, you know, the possibility of a congregation being composed of two Christians. He granted that, Matthew 18:20. Yes, a church could be a two-member church. But he says, now, just because you have two Christians doesn't mean you have a church. Well, I know that, and I didn't say that. But I said, if you do have a church that is composed of two members, then when they both do something, is the church doing it? He says, well, what if they both go fishing? Now, brethren, think about what that first premise said in my argument. The two members of the church go fishing on the peculiar grounds that they're Christians. Now, think about that. That's supposed to be a comeback, a sufficient answer, you know. They don't go fishing on the peculiar grounds that they're Christians. Now, if those two Christians in this two-member congregation practice religion, practice pure religion, each of them practice it according to his own admission, both of them can practice it individually. Well, if they both do it individually, both of them show up for the services individually. They come together as two individuals. When they practice this pure religion, is the church practicing it? Are you ready to swallow the notion that he advocated the church cannot practice pure religion? Now, that's what his doctrine says. Now, live with it if you can. It's a heretical notion. The very idea, the church cannot do it. The church is composed of us. We're the ones. By the way, on that one heart business, the mind of Christ, and love God with your heart. Acts 4:32, the brethren were of one heart. There's your heart. The church's heart, that group of people. That's just dodging the force of that argument that he does not really know how to answer. He says, well, the Gentiles could be merciful. That's my position. That's what I was saying. I never said that benevolence was somehow peculiarly attached to members of the church. He says, well, then we can all practice benevolence. It's not peculiarly done by Christians. Here's what I said. The church does it on the peculiar grounds that we're Christians. The world doesn't do that. That's why I went into those distinctions between moral law that have to do with the very fact we're made in the image of God and pure positive ordinances. God tells us to do things at a higher level of operation than just the fact we're all blood kin down here, made in the image of God. But now he wants us to do some things by virtue of the fact we have been converted. We are spiritual sons of God. Now show the world that. Is that difficult? The world does not practice benevolence as a demonstration of its spiritual sonship. The church does. The world does not practice Matthew 5:16, or it doesn't practice benevolence in conformity with Matthew 5:16, but the faithful church does. Now let him deal with that. No, we don't go fishing on the peculiar grounds we're Christians. If he ever understands that premise, he'll have an easier time understanding the rest of what I'm saying. But he hasn't understood that argument yet. It hasn't dawned on him yet what that means. Then he says, I said we can't help drunks. Well, maybe I need to clarify. Some drunks we can't help. Some drunks we make and help in some situations. There could be a man trying to get out of drunkenness. You can have a drunk that's been hit by a car. Can we give emergency aid to somebody who's been doing wrong? Yes. Let him say how we can't. Matthew 5, we can. There may be some that are unworthy, but there may be some that are deserving in some situations. James 1:27. Individuals can practice this. Remember, I anticipated what he was going to do with that? So he had up his chart a while ago. When he got James 1:27, he tried to point out that's individual, but he couldn't prove it. And that's why I went through that context earlier, 19:26, and I said, receiving the word and bridling the tongue and looking in the mirror and being a doer of the word, all that, that applies to the church as much as to one man. And he understands that, or he should. But then he said, yeah, but you get down here to widows and orphans. It's got some personal pronouns up there, and they're singular. Let him make an argument on that if he wants to. Are you trying to say every time a passage employs a singular pronoun, it's individual only? He won't do that. Now come up with a proof that James 1:27 is individual only. Let him do that. And if I didn't misunderstand, he said, a faithful element of the church can practice pure religion. I don't misrepresent him. I think when he was talking about the churches of Asia, in his quotation, I thought he said, the church doesn't practice it, but there can be a faithful element of the church that practices it. Whoa, wait just a minute. I thought this was peculiarly individual. It's singularly solitary. Oh no, we've got an element in the church. We've got some in Sardis that did not defile their garments. They shall walk with me in white. Well, what if the whole church is like that? Well, now wait a minute. If we get an element inside the church, we'll still say they can practice pure religion, but if it's the whole church, they can't. Is there any sense in that? You figure that out? Now that's what he's got to deal with. And then he says the church cannot worship and serve. I do! Remember he hollered it. I do! Well, what if you're in that congregation where the other fellow does it too? Where both of you do? Then do both of you practice pure religion? For the life of him, he won't say it. If both of us do it together, we're this two-member congregation. If we do it, we just do it as individuals. The church doesn't do it. Very idea. He quoted Guy Woods. Well, Guy Woods doesn't agree with him. Regardless of what Guy Woods said about anything, he knows that doctrine is false. The word Christian, it's a good word. There is a Church of Christ denomination. I hope he doesn't think that Church of Christ is the only scriptural designation for God's people. I'm not saying he does, but sometimes, you know, you can become sectarian even in the use of good expression. Church of Christ isn't the only scriptural designation. I had a former student, Daddy did too, Tennessee Bible College, preached for the Church of God denomination, Salina, Tennessee. Church of God is a scriptural designation. He wasn't preaching for a scriptural religious institution. He finally obeyed the gospel. It takes more than the designation to make it completely scriptural. I understand that. I suppose you understand that. I hope he understands that. But you do have to be scripturally identified. But there's not just one. If he thinks there's one, he's making up another law. But I'm not saying he's doing that yet. And then he referred to Floyd Decker. Floyd Decker left the Christian church. He wondered if he would have left if I'd been preaching. Well, it takes more than the discussion of the name to make a man right. The name is necessary, but it's not sufficient. Then it refers to the syllogism. My first syllogism yet stands. Chart number 8, please, Glenn, right quickly. Chart number 8. The implications of the saints only doctrine. If the church as the church helps its own only, what did the Lord say? That would mean in the light of Matthew 5, 45 through 47, it is not like God, and shows that it is composed of unfaithful sons. Now that's what he's trying to impose on the rest of us. Not intentionally, but the doctrine that he teaches demands that. If we help our saints only, our own people only, we're not like Christ, Romans 5:8. We're not even like the early church, 1 Timothy 5, verses 5 and 16. Chart P2. Now the Lord said in that context, we are to help our enemies, whoever his disciples are. Help your enemies. May the local church feed its enemies. Individual Christians are to feed and give drink to enemies under some circumstances. Romans 12, 20. Is that true or false? True. The local church is to feed and give drink to its enemies under some circumstances. True or false? You'd say true. If an individual Christian under the proper circumstances feeds and gives drink to his enemies, he overcomes evil with good. That's what Paul said he does. But does that context in Romans 12, out of which that discussion comes, is that restricted just to individual Christians acting in solitary fashion that keep themselves isolated from other members of the church? If the local church, under proper circumstances, feeds and gives drink to its enemies, does it overcome evil with good? I say it does. In the light of that passage, Romans 12, 21, it is true. Chart B5, men. The concept of purity. Pure religion, undefiled before God the Father is this. I would hate to advocate a doctrine that says the church cannot practice pure religion. That is outrightly absurd and contrary to everything the New Testament teaches about ethical obligation on the part of God's people. Look at the concept of purity. Matthew 5:8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Is that individual only? Does that apply to the church? Local, congregational, ethnic, regional, congregational, collective, universal? Does it get all of us? Can I preach to the church? Be pure, church. Be pure in heart. The heart all of us are supposed to have, the mind of Christ. Is the church to be pure in heart? Titus 2:14, we are to be a pure people. Jesus died to make us a pure people. Individually isolated from one another, collectively. Remember the question I asked you earlier? Does God demand that we be better individually than we are when we're together? What does the world see when it sees us? Well, if you get a member of the church by himself, he may be good to you. He may help you if you're in need. Don't let them find each other. Don't let them get together. Because they're more merciful alone than they are in association. Is that the doctrine of Christ? James 1:27. Does that apply to the church? An individual, pure religion, and undefiled before God the Father is this. Chart number 10. The real issue. The real issue is not that I don't make distinctions between individuals and churches. I mentioned in an earlier speech, I understand there are passages where individuals are being addressed like husbands, perhaps husbands and wives, and yet all the husbands are involved, and yet husbands have wives and wives have husbands and parents have children, all that. What I said was, I cannot find a passage where obligation on the part of brethren is stipulated on the basis of the spiritual condition of the one to get it or upon the numerical quantity of the ones to give it. I still haven't found that passage. And he hasn't brought it up tonight yet. The issue is not whether or not the Bible ever distinguishes between individuals and others. It surely does. And every time somebody's named in the Bible, you've got some individual name. But the issue, number two, is whether or not when individual action is distinguished from congregational, the reason for the distinction is the spiritual status, saint or non-saint, of the person in need. Chart 16a. Now, I asked a question a moment ago. Here's a chart on this. What does the world see when it looks at us? Even so, let your light so shine before men, they may see your good works and glorify the Father who is in heaven. We evangelize and we do benevolence as a part of evangelization that they may see our good works and glorify the Father. We don't do that like Rotarians. We don't do that like the Lions Club. And we don't do that like the Red Cross. And this is not like going fishing, because you can do that on grounds other than peculiar ones involved in your relation to Christ. But when you do things based on the fact you're one of God's own, we want the world to see that and come to the point in their lives when they give glory to God. Now, apostate Christians don't do it. People in the world don't do it. Who's supposed to do it? Just individuals? Isolated from one another? Or does it apply to the church as well? So, question at the bottom of the page. When the world sees the church helping its own but refusing to help others, will it be induced to glorify God? Jesus says the world does that. He wants the world to see congregations practicing an ethic higher than that. And then 16b, Glenn. Does the word of life, which the church is to uphold, according to Philippians 2:15 and following, does this word forbid the church from exercising a loftier ethic than that practiced by Gentiles? If the individual Christian can help non-saints, but the church can help saints only, why couldn't the world correctly conclude that the individual Christians are better by themselves than they are together as the church? Let him answer that. Now, basic argument two, chart three, Glenn. I want to introduce an argument, a second argument in this discussion. I need to get into this quickly. We only have these quick speeches and only two nights each in the affirmative. Basic argument two. If Christian A can benevolently help non-saint Z, allegedly because A is a Christian, but if it is a sin for Christians B, C, and D, and so forth, the rest of the congregation, to cooperate in assisting non-saint Z, then Christian A's authorization to render aid to non-saint Z must be for some reason other than he is a Christian. Now think about that very carefully. If I tell somebody that he can get on the boat because he is an American, and I act like that's it, that's the peculiar basis, that's what authorizes you to get on. You can get on the boat because you're an American. Somebody standing beside him is an American too, and I say, but you can't get on. Then surely, with that illustration, you understand there is more involved in the previous authorization. I didn't just let the first person on because he was an American. There might have been other reasons involved in my letting that person on. You see that? You can get on the boat. Why? You're an American. Well, I'm an American too, but you can't get on. Well, you let him on. If I keep the other one off and I let the first one on, regardless of what I say about the authorization, it's not just on the basis that he's an American. There is something else involved. There's some other basis involved in the authorization. So, if I can help you because I'm a Christian on the basis, but you cannot help that person on the basis that you're a Christian, then it was false to say that I could on that basis. There was some other reason why I was being allowed to do it. And I am saying, and that first premise and that first argument still stands, this is simply elaborating on that point. It shows that when one of us can do something because I am a Christian, the second one can do it, and the third one too, for the very same reason. The authorization is there. And the church is composed of all of the saved. Those who've been added together by God. And so when the Lord assigns one of us to do this on the peculiar grounds that I'm a Christian, not upon the peculiar grounds that I'm a father, not upon the peculiar grounds that I'm a preacher, not upon the peculiar grounds that I'm a deacon or an elder, on the peculiar grounds that I'm a Christian, then I'm saying all of us are authorized to do that as well. Minor premise. But it is false that Christian A's authorization to render aid to non-saint Z must be for some reason other than that he is a Christian, Colossians 3:17 would teach. Therefore, it is false that Christian A can benevolently help non-saint Z because he's a Christian, but it is a sin for Christians B, C, and D, and so forth, to aid in the assisting of non-saint Z. Okay, Glenn, I don't know if I gave you this one. Let's see, chart 6, if you've got it there handy. What constitutes the complete pattern? What is the pattern for benevolence? How do you find it? Can I find it in the words of the Lord in the biographies, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Can I find it in Acts, the history book of the origin and growth of the early church? And in analyzing the literature, how do I find it? Can I find it in examples? Yes, I can. Can I find it in direct statements? Yes, I can. Can I find it in implications? Yes, I can. The Bible gives me examples of what to do. It sometimes states my obligations without examples. I can find authorizations by implications. But I've got to utilize the complete category of authorization to find what the church is to do. Why won't Brother Padfield allow the Lord's remarks in Matthew 5 in the biography to serve as part of the authorization, the example for what the church can do? Remember one of the questions he asked me tonight? Does Matthew 5:44 and following include the church treasury? I say, yes, it does. He thinks it excludes it. Where do you go to find authorization? Do you just go after Acts 2 as the gospel is being preached at that time? I can find examples of the church doing certain things. There's one passage in the biography, the Lord taught something to be done. I never find an example of it. Can I go back to Matthew 5 and find how he told the church, told his disciples, Matthew 5, he's talking to his disciples, how you demonstrate sonship. Can I follow that example? Thank you much.